why is that normal? Doesn't that look
abnormal? And then I get freaked out when you say to me that, but that's not normal to me. Again, I'm in an echo chamber of very awake friends, which I've done purposely because of the trauma in my childhood. I wonder if I didn't have the trauma in my childhood that gifted the awareness, whether I would be the same. So I don't want to pass judgment them because maybe they've had like a really happy-go-lucky life and they're lulled into like automated behaviors. Yeah. Maybe that sort of ignorance is kind of bliss. Maybe that's what I talk about in chapter one when the therapist asked me, you know, what do you want to get out of this? And I was like, I just want to be one of those basic people that water just washes off the like criticisms, like water off the ducks. I want to be that person that is triggered by nothing because I'm just apathetic through life.
Hey, hey, and welcome to the 40s Formula, your go-to place for insightful discussions on navigating the 40s and thriving in this transformative decade.
We're your hosts, Jasmine and Amanda, two women that are passionate about exploring the challenges and adventures that come with turning 40 and what lies ahead.
Today on the 40s Formula, we're going to be talking about one of the five pillars of health that we haven't yet touched upon, and that is social connection and its antithesis, loneliness. Loneliness isn't just about being alone. It's about being unseen, unheard, and disconnected, even when you're surrounded by people. Our guest today knows this struggle firsthand and has dedicated her time to understand human connection. She's a global speaker, a best-selling author of Let's Talk About Loneliness, and an expert in helping people and companies bridge the gap between feeling connected and disconnected. And that's why we're so excited to have Simone Heng with us today in the studio. Welcome, Simone.
Hello. Thank you for having me, ladies.
Oh, it's our pleasure. We're so excited to have you here and to talk about loneliness, connection, disconnection. And I think we live in a time now where everyone is more connected. They're connected via social media, connected through their phones, the internet, even with the amount of people around them. But yet there's still so much loneliness. Why do you think that is?
So the loneliness epidemic that we're seeing globally, right, it's not just isolated to any country, is through what they call the conditions of modernity. And these are things like social media and the digital paradox. The way that our cities are planned now, they're no longer like when we stopped being nomadic as Homo sapiens, we planned our cities around a central place of worship or a piazza. Well, we don't build our cities that way anymore. We barely have third spaces. If you even want to sit in certain cities like London, you have to buy a coffee to Starbucks to even get a place to sit, to get out of the cold. So those third spaces have gone missing. We can also add to that capitalism. You know, we're seeing this even in China, which is not even meant to be a capitalist country right now, with overwork of young people due to the downturn of the economy for the first time in three decades. They're working so much, they barely have time for family. And that's huge when you come from from the Chinese diaspora or you're Chinese. It's one of the most filial countries in the world. Family comes first. And the fact that the conditions of capitalism have even incepted that culture shows you how pervasive some of these conditions of modernity are. So those are some of the things. I would add polarization and distrust in institutions as well as some of the contributing factors to loneliness.
You talk about in your book sort of being connected and being disconnected. Why do you think this is happening now? Why are people being more sort of disconnected from the world?
First, it's like, let's define what loneliness is. It's the gap between the kind and amount of human connection you want and the kind and amount of human connection you're getting. So you can be disconnected when you're surrounded by people, or you can be disconnected when connected to friends online. It's about quality of connection. And so even within your own family, if they don't share similar values or they're negatively polarized connections, as I talk about in the book, you can feel very lonely. I think the big why that it's that's happening right now is to do with some of the factors that I mentioned before. Let's look particularly at the digital space. And something that Dr. Pamela Rutledge, I was just speaking with at Harvard on Saturday night, she calls algorithmic isolation. I've talked about this before in terms of human connection and AI companions, but I never use that term. Algorithmic isolation is basically where you feel you're more alone in your hobbies, likes, views, inclinations, because your algorithm only shows you your own opinion looped back to yourself, right? And then when you come into contact with a new human being that doesn't reflect those views, you're more rigid in your opinions because you feel that you're in an echo chamber that's telling you you're right. And you're also more inclined to not bridge that gap and go through any sort of friction or discomfort to connect people. So I would say the biggest issue that we're having, why people are feeling more lonely, if we look at our generation, older millennials and below, could be to do with the polarization caused by these apps that we're on circulating our opinion back to ourselves, therefore also making us, I guess, a little reticent to go through the friction of making real life human connection, which is a bit messy, which is a bit, you know, there's a filtering process. You ladies found me on Instagram. We've walked in, we're wearing the same color palette, we're the same age, we have the same cultural East and Western understanding, we've talked before even recording, and the algorithm gave us each other. That was so easy.
Yeah.
So then why would I make an effort, right, is the psychology. And not everyone is as extroverted as me. So imagine someone's introverted, then they have to go to a dinner.
Yeah.
But they have to sit next to someone who obviously doesn't have the same algorithm as them. Why would they bother? So of course you're going to get less connection. We, in our analog childhood, which we all remember here, we had to go to school and we had to make friends. I had to go to Chinese Mandarin class on the weekend and make friends with people that definitely didn't have the same algorithm that wasn't around than me. And that it flexes your human connection muscles. That makes you a powerful social connector.
Yeah.
And the algorithms, I guess, have made us a bit lazy. We don't have to do that anymore.
Yeah. And I think everyone wants ease of life now, don't they? It's like
on demand.
Yes.
And if it's not immediate, if it's not easy, if it's not the same as what I think, then I don't really give a shit. Yeah. And I think that's what ends up happening.
And I think it gets veiled in this very therapized language now, which is all around, oh, I have a boundary. This is me. I'm protecting my time. It's like that can also get too much too.
Mm.
You need to, and anyone who has children who's listening, you need to also encourage your children to be able to have difficult conversations, to overcome friction in friendships, because their social skills, if they are socially fluent, they will stand out in the workforce of the future where they're going up against AI and everything's perfect and automated. AI will make everything human move higher up the value chain. So being a great human connector is a wonderful way to safeguard your children's future employment.
Yes. And girl, first of all, I don't know what your upcoming book title is, but if a book title exists called Analog Childhood, Lessons Learned from a Millennial, I don't know. I feel like there's something there.
Yes.
But
that makes me think. There's a passage in my next book.
Okay. Yeah. Again, I love the term analog childhood because I do think like that is now an antiquated, like that is something we can put on a shelf now and look at as something that no longer exists, right? Because it doesn't.
Yeah.
It's not something that these kids could ever.
We are the last generation.
We are the last ones that remember it, had it, could even vocalize it, right? Yeah. And that's going to get further and further away. What you mentioned about people with kids encouraging those kids to have experiences that make them uncomfortable and force them to kind of, like you said, confront a little bit of conflict, a little bit of, you know, wariness that they wouldn't otherwise have is a, again, for someone with no kids, girl, that is a parenting skill.
Oh, I'm auntie to 25 kids around the world. And I have to say, teaching your children to be uncomfortable comes also from making yourself uncomfortable. So the best way to model to them not to be on their phones all the time is obviously to have their phones away. And that's not me critiquing parents. It's because I have some amazing besties who model that to their kids, even though it's uncomfortable for them. So if they need to check the phone, she's, you know, my girlfriend will say, I'm sorry, sweetheart, I just need to check on my husband. And then it's not like I just do this without asking permission as if the person in front of me doesn't exist. Yeah. So she's modeling to the children. This is not a given that you can have your phone out. You must address the human in front of you first and the phone is second. I think it's incredibly powerful. And I try and be that auntie too.
You mentioned in your book that there was a situation where you took a friend out for dinner and he was on Tinder or one of the dating apps.
So bad.
And it feels like natural now to go out and, you know, everyone's out, but yet they're doing their own thing. Mm. And you mentioned how, you know, you were, it was almost like the behavior that you did when you were in your 20s and you found it uncomfortable, you know, you didn't like it. Why do you think people think that's the norm now? Like, what is it about people just finding that, you know, we could be out for dinner, but yeah, I'm going to be on my phone and you're going to be on yours.
I'm such a fan of human beings. I know I live in a really cynical world where most people are just like, everyone's an idiot. Yeah. I don't feel that way at all. I would say maybe it's my own in-person algorithm, but the people I'm surrounded by with now that I've moved into a place where I'm a force, and that is part of the title of the next book, is like, how, being a force in the world, I'm surrounded less and less by people who would not be aware and do something like that. Yeah. But the former version of me, with superfluous connections that were not necessarily quality controlled, because of my childhood, I never had great boundaries. Mm. There are people who are asleep to this stuff.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are awake. So I guess it's just, I think that's also what I always laugh about with my friends who are personal development authors as well. It's like, are we just writing to the already converted?
Yeah. Oh, that's a new question all the time.
Is this podcast just broadcasting to the already awake people?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I think that's also why dating's been really hard for me too. It's like I'm looking for someone with that level of awareness, which I don't think is the majority.
You know, I feel like you said, you know, we see the people that are there, but that's not a lot of the people. No. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, not to bring everything back to family. Like suddenly I'm like mama, you know, on this podcast, but like, same with families. It's like you see families go out to dinner and everyone is on their phone and the kids are on the iPad. And it's like, that is family dinner now. That is family dinner. And it's like, you know, why is that normal? Doesn't that look abnormal?
And then I get freaked out when you say to me that, but that's not normal to me. Again, I'm in an echo chamber of very awake friends, which I've done purposely because of the trauma in my childhood. I wonder if I didn't have the trauma in my childhood that gifted the awareness, whether I would be the same. So I don't want to pass judgment on them because maybe they've had like a really happy-go-lucky life and they're lulled into like automated behaviors. Yeah. Maybe that sort of ignorance is kind of bliss. Maybe that's what I talk about in chapter one when the therapist asked me, you know, what do you want to get out of this? And I was like, I just want to be one of those basic people that water just washes off the like criticisms, like water off the ducks. I want to be that person that is triggered by nothing because I'm just apathetic through life.
Do those people exist though? That's the thing.
Well, I later on found out that apathy is one of the lowest things on the vibrational scale of emotions. So it's actually not good to be apathetic. I don't think it should be the norm. I think there's enough information out there that it should be. But again, our algorithms are not their algorithms.
Yeah.
Can we go back to your childhood and the traumas you faced? It was part of what led you to feel lonely and disconnected. Can you share with us how that was and what that looked like for you?
I want to begin by saying that trauma is absolutely a gift when you've processed this trauma. So I can speak about it now in a very matter-of-fact way, but when I was writing the book, it was extremely emotional for me. And now I'm almost a bit desensitized. So anyone who is watching that is like, I'm like this because my mother was like that or my dad was like that or this is it. When you move from that victimhood to it being a victory, then you become a force in the world to do better things.
I can tell you, your book has made me cry multiple times. You know, I was reading it and it touched me in certain parts where I was just like, oh my God. So, you know, the fact that you have moved away from connecting the emotions means that you've definitely dealt with what was going on there.
And also a book launch will do that to you because you get asked over and over again. I mean, it's still difficult. I was just in Australia and, you know, my mum, she's got one good hand left and she hit me on the face. Like, you know, and it was kind of, she was trying to be funny in front of my cousin and that. It still breaks my heart because I absolutely hate, you know, hanging around the nursing home and hanging out in Perth. It's really not me at all as a place. And you make those sacrifices and then you get that. It's still hard, but I have boundaries now. So I'm like, okay, mama, I'm going to go back to auntie's house. I'll see you tomorrow. Like I have boundaries now, whereas me before, no boundaries. And we just keep kind of, I think the condition of many Asian daughters is to have no boundaries. You are taught that you must like flagellate yourself at the table of being a sacrificial Asian daughter. Mm. And I think a lot of my awakening is unwiring that, reparenting myself. I lost my dad when I was 19 years old, and he was like my best friend. And he was the kind of balancing force in my, in the family. Very, very similar to me, that very affectionate, very soft, very warm. And my mum and my sister are more alike. And my mum was a force, like definitely brilliant, definitely gifted, but probably a little bit ahead of her time. As such, had kids, but I think she was actually a bit more like me. Like, I think if she could have lived the life that I live now and fly all over the world and teach people stuff, she was a teacher at RGS, which is a very prestigious girls' school here in Singapore. I kind of think she would have, but she was born in another era. Yeah. So then she moves to the suburbs of Perth, and I think there's this frustration, and also she'd grown up with help in Singapore. So she's now having to manage these children that she's had really late in her life. So she's 37 when she has me and 35 when she has my sister, which is ancient for that era.
I was going to say, I was like, you know, my first one was when I was 38, but I hear you, but I hear you.
No, no, in that era. For that era, it was absolutely ancient. And her and my dad got married at 21 and 24.
Oh, wow.
And tried for 13 years. Yeah. And so I think all of these factors, along with her very rare condition that she has, led her to be, she was a very difficult mother. I'm not going to frame it in any other way. She was difficult. And it's interesting, after I wrote that book, like not one relative has come out and said that it was inaccurate, you know? Mm. And I actually think I protected her and my dad a lot. There are a lot of things that are not in there because they don't work with the thesis of loneliness. So the book is not a memoir, it's about loneliness. Okay. But within this family system, those unpredictable moods, obviously, of one of your primary caregivers impacted me by, I developed a very anxious attachment style. Mm. That shows up for me mostly in dating, sometimes with friendships, but not so much. Not in work, luckily. And along with that, I felt a lot of loneliness within my own family system. And I still feel that now when I go back and visit, that I am wired so differently, and was even then, to the rest of my family. I don't have this kind of Singapore risk aversion that the rest of the community that I grew up in has. I literally am very anti-authority. Like at the radio that I used to work at, they thought I was like the rebel. Like, I am, compared to like America or the UK, I am not a rebel. I'm like a rule follower. But in the context of like a local organization, that is just the best mindset to have as an entrepreneur. So again, all the things that are crushing and make you feel different and are wounding, honey, you're just not in the right place. Mm-hmm. Like, I would never be able to do what I do now I travel all over the world as a woman alone. If I was risk averse or a rule follower, God help me.
That would not be happening.
I made no money.
Amanda, you know we love the Meat Club, but you know what's even better than their premium ethically sourced meats?
What's that?
Getting $250 worth of your shopping for free. And that's exactly what we're going to be doing in our season 5 giveaway.
All you have to do is show us the delicious meals that you make using the Meat Club products. Tag at the 40s formula and at the Meat Club SG on Instagram or TikTok, and you stand a chance to win $250 worth of the Meat Club goodies.
It can be a photo, a reel, and don't worry if your account's private. Just drop us a DM and we'll count your entry.
We'll be picking one lucky winner at the end of the season. So make sure to submit all those delicious meals before June 5th.
It's time to jump in the kitchen and get cooking, and we cannot wait to see what you make.
It all worked out as it was, but I felt crippling. Look, I still feel quite lonely when I go back to Australia, and I am to Perth particularly, and I tend to not meet up with many people. So I go visit mum and my cousin and best friend, and I see my godkids, but I try not to have coffees, and I try, because it sometimes, again, the algorithm thing that we talked about, my mindset now is so expansive. Yeah. And my palette for experience and what I consider exciting is very broad. And that's not for everyone. And it isn't necessarily, that's not necessarily a place where that comes up a lot. And so sometimes when I have that coffee, I get that cognitive dissonance that actually makes me feel I'm alone more, which is uncomfortable. Yeah. So I try not to do too many family dinners. I try not to do that because it is just triggering for me of the kind of loneliness I don't want to be reminded of. And I think that's just human.
During your journey, was there like a pivotal moment which really made you realize that I need to seek help and try to sort out, you know, what's going on in my mind.
Yeah. So I always talk about after Dad died at 19, it was terrible, but all the aunties were like, you know, get over it. Stop crying. He's dead already. What do you want to do? You know, be strong for your mom. Like all of this kind of, and I realize a lot of relatives or older generation, but I'll talk about my Singaporean family, find grief uncomfortable and the display of grief uncomfortable. Yeah. So they're not saying that to be mean to you. They're saying to you because they're like, please stop showing me these intense emotions. Yeah. It is uncomfortable for me. But instead of saying, hey, I might not be the right person to talk this, but I'll find you someone, or let's, their way is like, stop showing it to me. So I understand it now, but at the time I was kind of brainwashed in this filial piety to listen to anyone of authority, even if they knew nothing about mental health, to follow exactly what they said. This idea of obedience was a really big thing in my house, about being obedient. My mum was really fearful of having like wild Australian children, which she ended up getting one anyway. So if your mum listening, don't be too strict because it could just come out sideways. So I listened to them, and so I pushed all that grief inside me, and then I went off to work around the world, and the grief just came out sideways. Mm-hmm. I talk about in the book, I was so angry. Mm-hmm. Like the rage of being silence, the rage of having my father taken away from me, the rage of some of the things that went on in that house, but also the wider family. Like it was how people spoke to each other, how people gossiped about each other, how people put each other down. Like I knew I had never experienced differently, but when I went to live in Switzerland, I realized what I had seen in American shows existed, because I lived with three different families and no one talks about each other or puts each other down or shouts. And I was like, wow, that's how I want to live the rest of my life. And we're there, girls.
Well, hey.
Yeah, I'm like literally sitting here in shock that like America had a great example.
Well, it was
a great job, America.
Golden Girls, Family Matters, and ALF. It was perfect.
First of all, back in the golden era of American television, which is unmatched and will never come again. But anyway, but yeah, exactly. It's great to hear that we brought something good to the world.
Exactly. And then I was in Dubai and then mum had the big stroke. And I had decided like, okay, you know you have to go deal with this. My mum had kind of told us from the time we were little, if anything happens to mummy, it was always, if anything happens to mummy, you come back. If anything happens to mum. So it was programmed. It's sometimes shocking to me that I never even had an independent thought of like, you're living the life of your dreams. Is this a reasonable request that you would give up your happiness and life for the generation that comes after you that will die before you? But in the Asian family system, you don't question that. That's not how that's done. And so I left Dubai, and then I talk about in the book, the pot boiled over. So I realized like I was not equipped for going back to the ground zero of my childhood trauma that I'd escaped from, that I was running away from. And all of that scar tissue from Dad's loss, that unresolved rage, it just blew up. And that is the part where I'd come back to Singapore to work after taking care of my mum, cleaned up the hoarding in my mum's house. And then I'd come back to work at this radio station here in Singapore. And it was very similar to my family system environment. So DJs were pitted against each other in the same way my sister and I pitted against each other. Like my therapist even said, like, it's like your anxious attachment style will just walk yourself. Your trauma bond will walk yourself right back into a place. Yeah. Where you can relive that in your nervous system. And so it was all the things. It was the put downs, the gossiping, the meaning between the lines. So never that clear communication, always the bitching behind the back. So all of these things were, I couldn't relive it anymore. It was untenable. And I called my cousin and my best friend one night, and she was pregnant with my goddaughter. And I bawled down the phone to her, and I just could not stop crying. And then at the end of it, I asked for advice. And I would do that routinely when I couldn't regulate my own emotions. I would call trusted friends and they would help me to regulate, but they weren't professionals. And Paula said to me, she goes, Moni, I love you, but maybe it's time, because I don't have all the answers to fully give to you. And I later on went back to her and told her, this was the best. I mean, it took 10 years, But I said to her, this is like the best advice you ever gave me. And was given with such love. Yeah. It wasn't in this like go to therapy. It was in with such love and a relationship with which we have complete trust. Yeah. And she said, yeah, I'm about to become a mum, so I'm trying to give better advice.
Oh, that's lovely.
I might not have kids, but kids have a very special place in my life, you know. They just make friendships with my girlfriends even more rich because we just have more girls to hang out with. Oh, there's a couple of boys in the mix, but most of the girls. They're hard work. The boys are hard work. There's like a lot going on there.
You're telling me
the girls are a bit easier, you know. You take them to Din Tai Fung and give them a colouring book and they're just good.
Yes.
So that was the big story. And I hope everyone has a person, and I know that's not true because of the loneliness research I do, but I hope everyone has a person that they trust completely and they love unconditionally who can give them that advice and it land well for them.
So how did you go from feeling disconnected in your personal life to making connection your life's work?
Three things happened. Number one, I had been seeing that old media was becoming less and less relevant. That was really obvious to me. This was 2016. It was getting obvious to me, right? And so a lot of the reasons you go into the media is there are a lot of perks. It's fun. But there had been so much darkness that happened. The fun didn't mean anything to me anymore. I wanted more. I knew I needed more. And then at the same time, mum, because the cognitive disease, was losing her ability to remember her own memories. Mm-hmm. And the last big indicator was I went on air one night and I gave away tickets to a superhero movie. And I asked people to voice note into the station, if you could have any superpower in the world, what would it be and why? And this young girl, her name was Mei Xuan, she voice noted in, I know it's not a special ability or anything, but I would really love to be able to connect with people one-on-one. It seems like everyone's so cold these days. And that was the alarm.
Wow.
Because she was younger than me by about 10 years. I could tell by her voice. And I was like, there's something here. And so I started researching. I found a mentor who is a global keynote speaker. And I worked under him. He actually gave me the human connection topic because he thought I was a great connector. I think I'm a 100 times better connector now than what I was then. There was just so much stuff going on. To be a great connector, you really have to be others driven. And when you've got a lot going on with you, it's really difficult to be able to have that cup flowing over for other people. And certainly I'm at that place now, but at that time I wasn't. And I just started researching. And then the research started to heal me because there were a lot of studies that were like, oh, I'll give you a perfect example. There's a study by Dr. James Cone at the Virginia University that talks about how high quality touch of a person that is a trusted connection has the ability to lower someone's stress response versus being held by a random caregiver or somebody where it's not a high quality relationship. And so there I was flying every 90 days all of my annual leave at this radio station to lie on the floor of that nursing home next to my mum, was feeling like, oh my gosh, is this worth it? Does she even realize I'm here? Does she appreciate this? And then to go, yes, she does, because that's your hand lowering her stress response, extending her lifespan. The hand of her carer does not give her the same effect. Yeah. So you see how the research
that's the oxytocin.
Helped. Yes, the dopamine. It all helped me.
Yeah.
And so I think for a lot of people come to me and they want to be global keynote speakers and they think I live this lifestyle. They don't understand. You need to do the research.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just write a keynote and make stuff up. Like, the research is important. And those researchers then kept me company in a pandemic because I was ready to start the business. And then the pandemic hit.
Mm.
And as a keynote speaker, travel is a huge part of your job because no conference can use you multiple years in a row. Yeah. You're not like an MC. So if you look at the entire world, yes, you'll make a great income for the whole year. But if you only speak in one market, you probably will not. Mm. And so there was no flying. And so I just became really well acquainted. I just did the study. And now I sit on the board in Washington, D.C. for the Foundation for Social Connection.
Amazing.
With people whose names were like my best friends alone in my apartment during the pandemic. And I got to meet them in person. And a couple of them, we really get along. We've got catch-up calls. And like, that blows. Like, you were a name in a footnote.
Yeah.
And now you endorse my book and we're friends. And when we're in New York at the Benjamin Franklin Awards and we go have ice cream together. Like, it's The world, the universe is mind-blowing. And this is why when I talk about that expansive mindset, why I'm so careful when I do go home, I don't want to be confronted by a closed mindset because I don't want that portal to close.
Yeah.
Like the portal's now open.
Yeah.
Let's not throw trash in the portal, kids.
That's right.
Yeah. So for someone who thinks they might be lonely but isn't 100% sure because, you know, they're living in a home with other family members, or, you know, they go to work every day and sit in an office space, what signs or symptoms can they look out for to make them understand that actually there may be some some disconnection there?
So a big one that I personally went through my whole entertainment career was being very quick to cut people off. So what you'll do is you hold higher people to a higher standard than is reasonable. Your friend, her child vomited and she's late. You'll be like, in your mind, you'll be like, that's not a good friend. I'll mark that against her name. So holding people to a higher standard is reasonable. Less than good quality sleep. Wanting to be around people, but immediately then going, oh my God, this is so much. I want to withdraw and go home immediately. Oversharing. Really, really lonely people will overshare.
Yes. This is something I have definitely noticed is a lot of times in our line of work, right, someone comes to us for nutrition help, fitness help, but it's not nutrition and fitness help. They really just want a captive audience for a completely different story.
Yeah.
You know, that is deeply personal, deeply psychological, and probably not the right venue.
And they really want to be heard. This is why I stopped public speaking coaching, because it was a lot of this. I do believe that finding your metaphorical voice is linked to things that happen in your childhood, but I'm not qualified for that. And too many people were coming to me for that. Yeah, so the oversharing really is like you are just in this state of threat that you might not see someone again who you can talk to. So you are dumping that.
And that feels awkward for the other person who's like, it just met you and it's like, ooh.
So it repels the exact kind of connection you want to attract, tells the other person's brain to be skeptical of you because you can't hold on to your own secrets. You're never going to hold on to theirs.
Yes.
We are wired to be a bit skeptical, of course, for a survival mechanism when we meet a new person.
Yeah.
And I've definitely been through that. When I first moved back to Singapore in 2015, I remember being on a plane to a hen's night in Bali. It's the same hen's night that I write in the book that my cousin on that hen's night created a group chat to bitch about me. Some of the stuff you're just like, and me now being so empowered, I would never, like my boundaries now, I mean, but I had that trauma bond. Yeah. So my bond said, if someone's family, you love them. No, honey, no. Mm,
yeah.
If you're cruel to me or one of you, full stop, you're out. That's it. So I was on this plane and I had met a captive audience, a girl and her mum next to me, and I just was monologuing to her to the point the lady in the front turned around and was like, we're trying to sleep and we know your whole life story. And it just broke my heart. It's so interesting now though, knowing the place that I'm at now, I would never speak to someone I didn't know like that. I would just be, we know so much more in the last 10 years and post pandemic about mental health, loneliness, all these things. Well, I would just never be like that to someone.
Because that could be the thing that triggers. I mean, that could be the thing
completely.
That then that person, you never know.
You never know.
You know, and I don't want to be the darkest dark here, but,
no,
like,
but it's
that
true.
Could be the night that that person says,
I mean,
see,
and then I went on that hen's night, was treated terribly. Like sometimes I think, thank goodness I am as strong of a person as I am and as hyper independent as I am, because if you had counted all these things and a lot of them you read in the book and a lot of them aren't, how on earth am I still like, what up? Hello?
Can we talk about hyper-independence?
Yeah.
Whenever I think about loneliness, this is going to sound dark, but I'm going to bring it back. So whenever my husband and I have this chat, I think everyone who's partnered has this chat at some point, who's going to die first? Or at least, you know, speculating. And I'm always like, you're going to die first for a million reasons. I always tell him. Statistically, you know, women who have kids after 40, we live forever. It's like a whole thing. But I was like, so when you die, I was like, I'm not going to remarry because I love being alone. I don't think I've ever felt lonely. Can I be honest with you?
Unmarried women are statistically the happiest portion of the population.
Good job, us.
Yep.
But like, you know, when people say like, you know, I'm alone but not lonely, First of all, I'm never alone. So I think that's what it is, with that statement aspirationally, because I'm never alone. But I always
all think, my girlfriends say that with kids. They're give me like, murder on the couch. Are you kidding?
Can you imagine?
They're like, hang your macrame. Yeah. What is going on?
Can you imagine entering your home and not hearing a cacophony of sounds? You know, from every single angle. But anyway, so I'm like, is it possible, right? If you have this kind of natural or learned hyper independence, to not be lonely ever?
So firstly, hyper-independence is a maladaptation to trauma. I think that's a little bit different. And people with like, I'm a little bit strange because I have an anxious attachment style, but I'm hyper-independent. but normally people with a dismissive avoidant type, they are more hyper-independent. They're like, I don't need people, blah, blah, blah. So no wonder I'm single. I must confuse. I defy the boxes. But what I was going to say to you is that knowing how to be in solitude, this is a big part of my second book, is an absolute essential life skill. Knowing how to like your own time, be in your own space is beautiful. And that's not wrong. And I'll just reiterate, statistically, unmarried women are the happiest in the population. Married men are the second happiest in the population. And good married thing. Women, probably not in our city or like Dubai with full-time help. With children, statistically, the most unhappy section of the population.
Oh, see, I thought I misheard you. I thought you said married women are the happiest. Unmarried women are the happiest. Yeah. Married men. Yeah. And then, and I get that.
Because you're
in the conventional model.
Because you're pouring.
Oh, I'm so hungry.
Oh my gosh, same. On recording days, I am the hungriest.
GYG?
Yeah, of course. What are you thinking?
Should we try their new chicken rendang?
Yeah, that's actually not a bad idea.
It's their special SG60 launch. Slow-cooked Guerrero marinated chicken in a rich rendang sauce with coconut, lemongrass, and over 10 aromatic spices. Sounds incredible.
And it arrives so fast.
Oh, wow, this is yum.
God, this is so good.
Oh, my God, Amanda, I wish our audience could try this too.
Actually, why don't we make that happen?
Yes, so here's the deal. We're going to give away 10 free chicken rendang burritos or bowls. And all you need to do is 1, jump on your favorite podcast streaming site and leave us a review. And then 2, screenshot that review and send us a DM on Instagram at the40sformula.
And that's it. It's first come, first served. So our first 10 DMs will receive their free food. And make sure you get it in before 4th of May.
So get reviewing, get DMing, and get ready to enjoy some seriously healthy but fast food.
And make sure you check out the limited time only chicken rendang at all GYG outlets, but only until May 4th.
We live in the 1%, let's be honest. Yeah. We don't live in what our friends in Australia, America, the UK live, okay? Yeah. Auntie stays over at all the houses. So I'm there from the morning so I see the energy outlay, the cognitive load. The brain filled with what snacks can I make for Monday for the lunchbox? You know, no one's sitting around going, let's write our third, fourth book. No. Like people are, when the babies are young,
not even like, let me have my third, fourth cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Much less
Simone, if they don't shower, I don't get to shower. And I was like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
It's a shower. I got 30 products. I just gave you girls 4 of my 30 products. Yes. Like what do you, but that is the reality. Yes. And I think there's something about being friends with these amazing women in all these different countries are all doing differently definitely makes me realize the value of the real estate of the alone time and to use it well. So you will not see me drunk out in the club. Like I'm building and making something because my person is coming.
Yeah.
And when that time comes, you're not macrameing watching murder and living your best life.
Are you macrameing?
I macrame.
You are so cool.
It calms my nervous system. Anything tactile helps to whoop. Yeah. And the publishing process at this end of where I'm at is quite stressful. So the macrame helps. Yeah. But back to this thing. So you're not hyper independent, honey. You're just someone who is well-rounded enough to know that time on your own is good. I'd be more worried if you're like 20 days later, you go and remarry, which by the way, a lot of men in those murder shows I watch, they get divorced, boom, it's next wife. Yeah. Hello, Chris Watts.
Yes.
What? So you see.
I see that in real life though too. I don't want to go down that path of widowers, but like I see
that a lot. And that's a lot of the time there's something called the widower's effect that a man will pass away shortly after a woman due to the fact that she ran the social connection calendar for the household. So without her and even knowing how to operate that orchestra, all of his social connection disappears. And then, therefore he, because social connection does loneliness spikes a stress response in our body. Mm. That can lead to cardiovascular disease. It's most common of all the illnesses, but lots of other life-shortening conditions. So your social connection should be factored in like any part of your health routine.
It is one of the six pillars of lifestyle medicine, by the way.
Yeah, yeah,
but like
for sure.
Designated by the Society of Lifestyle Medicine. Yeah. Like that's its social connection is the sixth.
I was speaking with Dr. Robert Waldinger.
Yeah.
That's his whole study of the lifespan of humans.
Yes.
The one thing that extends lifespan. Julian Holtlandstad, that's my bestie from the foundation. She is the person who coined the stat that loneliness is more dangerous for your health than obesity and alcohol use disorder. So it's not a joke. And I am my own guinea pig. I know all of this. I went to a networking thing on the weekend because multiple of my friends are leaving Singapore. But now I met you two and you're in the car. We're going to do dinner.
We are.
And I'm that annoying person that doesn't just say it. I only say that to people I actually want to meet with. And then I follow it up.
Well, then you're going to have to see how much food I eat, which
then you're really going to see how much I talk.
Amanda is on an anabolic journey right now. So.
Yes, yes. So like I said, I will listen and eat and you talk.
I love an eater. I'm an eater.
I'm also an eater.
Good.
So I have to watch what I eat, unfortunately.
I don't even think I have any non-eater girlfriends. Well, we all love to eat. All of my
you've
friends.
Got the right friends.
I feel like that's, I feel like that's maybe the seventh pillar of lifestyle.
Food is such a wonderful connector. Yeah. And when we eat in connection, we digest our food differently.
Ooh.
So they studied people in Sardinia in one of the blue zones, and they were eating complex carbohydrates that in the rest of the world, things like pasta and bread, we're told are bad for us and cause all these issues. Well, in Sardinia, the way that they are firstly harvesting these grains, then cooking these grains communally as a family, and then eating communally instead of in front of a laptop watching murder shows on their own, they're eating in a calm stress rate. Their body digests the food differently because they're in connection.
Do you think that social media is making us lonelier then?
I'm obviously very active on socials. I think if you're a very young person and you didn't have analog childhoods like us and you were not able to draw boundaries, absolutely.
Mm.
I think every person who gets to see this should, in the book I talk about my social media boundaries. So I post and ghost. I do not scroll. Everyone's like, how do you get so much done? I was like, because I don't scroll. And I see all you guys watching my IG stories. So I know you scroll. I don't scroll. I post, ghost. I comment. I reply the comments under the post to thank those people. But I probably don't have as much views or engagement as I should because I don't scroll. The algorithm wants me to do that.
Yeah.
So.
And you are not a rule follower.
I'm not a rule follower. And I value my mental health too much after what I've been through to let myself go down a comparison trap or worse. What could be worse than you have goals and dreams of what you want to achieve? You're middle-aged. And then you get comparisonitis. Scrolling what everyone else is already doing because they've already set it up. And then you look at your watch and the 2 hours you could have been using to do your business plan is now gone. And then you're in an anxiety spiral of what you're not doing. And I get a lot of DMs from women like that, who are frustrated that they're not making progress. But I know because I see them watch the IG stories what they're doing with their time. Mm. So boundaries, and everyone should just have their own, whatever makes them happy is what you should do with socials. Don't follow people that make you unhappy.
Oh,
clean what that algorithm shows you. And when Dr. Pamela Rutledge and I were speaking to the kids at Harvard on, I mean, can you hear the statement that I just said? That's a manifestor's dream from someone who in 2017 was like put out to pasture in their radio career, doing night shift, demoted, hating their life, and dreaming of that exact statement. That is, it's unbelievable even to me. So Pamela was saying to them, have these boundaries. Social media is not the enemy. And to actually see, so they would be quite young Gen Z, I guess they're 19, 20.
Yeah.
That was news to them. That worried me.
Yeah.
Because I realized they've had it their own life,
their whole life.
They don't know another life.
They don't think they're allowed to be analytical or critical of it. The way we used to watch TV and be like, well, the news is the news. Fox News is the news, babe. That's what's reality. And now, of course, we know that's not true at all. So it was remarkable to me that we had to even say, well, have you thought about journaling some boundaries? But that's the truth if you've always had it.
I give talks to student athletes, young student athletes. And one of the bullet points I've now had to add on my slides is if you're looking at bodies that are different from yours and you don't like you, if you like yours less because of the bodies that you're looking at on social media. And again, for female athletes, this gets very relevant, right? Because they start to develop muscles and they, you know, pubescent athletes, right? Their bodies change, you know, whatever, toward their sport. And I was like, if you're looking at bodies constantly that make you feel worse about your body, and then that's going to affect your performance in your sport because you don't like the body that you're seeing on, you know, that you see in real life versus the internet, you have to go through and clear that out. And again, these girls have never heard it. These girls have never heard this before
saying,
in their lives.
I was like saying, you don't have to unfollow, just use the mute function.
Yeah, just,
and they were like, oh no, they're just accepting everything TikTok showed them. Oh, honey, no.
No. And again, for every one body that you look like, that doesn't look like yours, maybe look at one that does look like yours. So like maybe we can balance it out as
That's what I love. Is it Morgan Mahler?
Yeah.
The rugby player?
Yes.
Oh my God, I love that.
Alona Maher.
That's it.
Yes. And I probably said it wrong. I think it's Mare, Maher. Anyway,
she's amazing. She's amazing.
Exactly.
When she was like, imposter syndrome, I've never had that.
Never had it.
I was like, that's me.
Yes.
Like, that's me when it comes to work. I've never, which is why it was also really isolating when I came to Singapore to be bullied. Because I'd never really been bullied about my abilities before. Mm. And that was very lonely.
Yeah.
So loneliness and low self-esteem.
What would you say has been the most surprising thing that you've figured out or read about or experienced in your research about self-connection or connections or loneliness?
The biggest one is about, and you may have already seen this, is about the five intimate connections around you, right? And how huge their influence is on your performance. Mm. And I saw this very realistically in 2018. I had my first big friendship breakup that it was my choice. And I'd realized that when I was around these people, there was a lot of, again, replication of my childhood home, sitting around gossiping, talking about people. It was really unhealthy and it was wasting my time. And then I found out that this particular girl, and I worshipped her, again, anxious attachment style, had been saying stuff about me. So of course they were. They were, you know, it's so logical to me now. Like if you're hanging out with people that talk about people all the time, what do you think is happening when you're not there? And so I cut that friendship off.
How do you cut it off? Do you say to that person, I'm no longer your friend? Or do you just ghost them?
I'm a terrible non-confrontational Asian. I would not do this now, but this is me 2019, okay? It's a long time ago now. It was tough because I found out from her sister that she'd been saying things because, so obviously then if I was to disclose that, they might have a lifelong buster.
Yes.
So I didn't say anything. It was her birthday. I dropped off a gift for her birthday at the, like of her condo, like the front thing. And I just made sure I was never, it was a wedding where we were at the same, but I just avoided and it became very clear. Yeah. Actually, the pandemic happened and made it really easy for me. Mm. But what I saw happen to my life when I cut this person. So if you have in your five intimate connections, so I've had people like that before, but they were on the periphery, but I'd never had anyone in the inner circle. You can pull out that thorn. It's unbelievable how my life changed. That means energetically, if anyone's a bit woo-woo watching this or listening to this, the secret hating from her and her husband was vibrationally kind of actually keeping me low, even though I wasn't aware of it.
Wow.
So I'm really much more sensitive now when I meet women who I know are not happy for me, or I can see them watch all the stories and they don't like it and then they copy my content. I'm very aware, but because I have solved a lot of that anxious attachment style, it's like saying I value me to the universe, that I don't do the puppy dog thing that where I would try and convert them. Mm. You're never going to convert someone who's your secret hater.
Yeah.
Like that is illogical. You have macrame to do. Like, let's get, like, you're this.
You have macrame and murder shows.
Murder shows to watch. Forget it, lady. Anxious attachment style, me running after my mother's affection would have done that to any women who are kind of difficult because they resemble the primary caregiver. So for anyone who doesn't know basic like childhood therapy here, you know, a lot of the way we connect with other people is influenced by the connection we had with our primary caregiver and whether our emotional needs were met or not met. And the reason I mention that is a lot of people pick up my book and they think it's about loneliness. And I was probably the first person in my group of people who talk on human connection to write a book where I gave a piece of myself in it to talk about how this shows up to how we later make friends and how we maintain friendships. So I could see the toxicity I was self-creating because I took that paradigm as a given, that that was a skeleton that I should live by. And it's not at all a skeleton you have to live by, but the work of breaking away that infrastructure of your emotional life is so difficult. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it.
Yeah. But it is work. Yeah.
It is work. And I still constantly have to do it. And my love life has been I have a dating coach now. So all of 2025, we are attacking this. Last year, I took a break from dating and I just read all the books on attachment style in romantic relationships you could imagine. And this year we attack that. It's the last place for me that it really shows up in my life, and it will keep being managed forever.
I feel like that's your fourth book. So we've got your real two books, and then we've got the analog childhood, and now we've got the result of this dating.
Oh, well,
year.
There's a book on AI companions and human connection that I want, but that could be the analog childhood.
Yeah, those could
wanted to call the book, you know, The Last Generation, because we are the last generation, and then the subtitle will have, you know, analog childhood. My friends are like, oh, you should write a book on, you know, the dating stuff, and I'm like, I don't feel people want that message until you've found the person, because then they've got time to.
Which you will, though. Yeah. So that's why I'm confident you can write this book.
Or even if I don't, where you're so badass, where you learn everything and then you're like, oh my God.
I don't need someone.
And then you're like, I don't need someone now.
Yeah.
I think that's half the problem. I don't need
if
someone now.
If the dating coach is listening.
But if you get to the point where, like, I would be lying if I said I still don't have moments where I want that. But I do, they get less every year. I do think it is, like, I watch Jane Fonda and I know for sure that she's definitely, that woman is that point where she's like, I really, like, I don't miss that. Mm-hmm. I'm already at the point, sadly, and I think this comes across very strongly, where I no longer crave someone to travel with and I no longer crave someone to be at home in the evenings with. And that was a big thing before I turned 40, that I would have that craving. Now when I travel, oh my gosh, I'm so tired and I'm love a good hotel room with a bath. I'm so happy no one is there in that space. Mm. Like, I'm like, woo! Room service, chicken parmigiana, murder on the laptop, woo! Some of my married girlfriends, like one of the nurses at my face doctor, she's like, that's the dream. And then you have other people who are like, oh no, it's not like that when you meet the right person. And I was like, oh, you're so smug right now. I was like, I just met you. That's too smug. But I don't say that. I just feel that inside. But I think that it is very possible. Like when I watch a Jane Fonda, I know she's at that point because I'm probably only 5 or 6 years away from where you're completely cool. But you want what you want when you want it.
Yeah.
That's part of the journey. I'm going to watch this podcast back in 2 years and laugh at like how wrong I was about everything I said.
So we are coming to the end of the show now, but we do have one last question that we want to ask you. And that's, what's your 40s formula, especially with being connected not only with yourself, but with others around you?
You know you have to put the face mask on you first. And I always used to throw that out the window because I'm like, I only have to show up for my disabled mother. But I really, besides her and the dog, I'm not, and I was so wrong. I was so wrong. So I would give all of my energy power away to my career and my work. And no, you still have to put, even if you're single, looking after your health, looking after your mind, your personal development, all of that into your 40s becomes paramount, absolutely paramount. And then the rest of it, secondary, easier said than done.
Face mask on first. Thank you so much, Simone. It has been an absolute pleasure having you here.
Yeah, thanks for making time for us.
Of course.
Let's be real. Perimenopause is a game changer. One day you're cruising along and the next your body puts a spanner in the works. Sometimes symptoms feel manageable. Others, well, let's just say we have to breathe through those.
And I'm not there quite yet, but the research shows that staying strong physically and mentally makes a world of difference.
That's why Great created Menopause Mojo by Great Moves. It's a fitness program designed just for this stage of life. It helps with pelvic strength, breathing exercises, and muscle training, everything you need right now.
And we've got a special deal just for you, listeners of the 40s Formula. Use code TFFSPECIAL at checkout to get your first class for only $50.
Or go all out and save 33% off a 5-session starter pack.
Your body's changing, but you're still you, and you deserve to feel great. Let's get moving with Great.
Guys, you know we love coffee. And if you want to show us some love, you know you can always get us one.
Just visit buymeacoffee.com/the40s formula.
Cheers. Cheers.
Before we go, please remember to hit subscribe and take a moment to support the 40s formula by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Your reviews will help us to reach more people and allow us to continue to bring valuable content. It should only take a moment, and it's a free way for you to support the show.
You can also stay updated with the 40s Formula by following us on Instagram at the 40s Formula, all one word. We share behind-the-scenes insights, episode updates, and much more, so please be sure to hit that follow button.
We appreciate your time and support. Thank you for being part of this community, and we'll be back next week for more empowering conversations with inspiring guests.
Bye. Bye.
Still know. Going through
By
it.
By the way, how badass is the 40s?
Oh, it's amazing.
Sis,
it is literally
why
the best.
Why did no one tell me?
Oh my gosh. And why like, did no one get old? I was like, you actually do. This is counterpoint. It's amazing.
We're really blessed here.
We are
so lucky.